Looks like we only have about 10-15 minutes for questions before our break. So, okay, these are the questions now that have been written. First question is to Dr. Zadeh Cam. You mentioned in the beginning of your presentation that there is no difference in mortality for dialysis patients in the U.S. and Germany. Does the dialysis unit you showed us in Germany feeding burgers to patients have a lower mortality rate than other dialysis units? And actually, I was thinking here we have these gigantic databases in DaVita and Fresenius, and some feed people, some don't. So I think one logical way to answer this question would be to do a comparison. And you could do a cluster randomized study, but first step could be an observational data set. So, Cam, what's the U.S. data and what's the German data?
Well, it's a very difficult question to compare apples and oranges. What I said that if you go to one of those conferences where a bunch of Europeans are sitting there, and they're all my friends. I went to medical school there. I liked them a lot. And they always say that you Americans are doing inferiorly, you are bad, you are this. Just always smile to them and say thank you, but there is always something when they say, and some of them are great friends, are sitting here. Their mortality is not, I said, not much better. I said that Europe in general, their dialysis mortality is maybe between 12 to 15%. Ours is 18%, 17 to 18%. So we are a few percent higher than them. But I can't quite say that it's because of those nice meals that are served in Germany or in Belgium during dialysis units. So maybe there is something there, definitely. The patients are happier. I think we just need to look at also patient satisfaction. My talk was based on patient-centeredness. What I'm here to tell you that we are not making any harm. Now, again, is this... are we one of the worst dialysis mortality among developed countries? Probably we are not one of the best. But always remember, United States doesn't have the best life expectancy either. We are embarrassingly in a country where our life expectancy is not even top 10 in the world. So therefore, if your life expectancy as a walking, talking nephrologist is not good, how do you expect your dialysis patient's life expectancy to be any better given the background?
Okay, good. We have to keep the responses short because I've got a lot of questions here. Okay, now to Dr. Agrawal, how do you treat malnutrition in dialysis patients since amino acids are dialyzed? Is it useless to provide IDPN? There's another opinion, Ray, IDPN for low albumin in hemodialysis patients. And Cam, of course, you can chime in after Rajiv on this. And is there a middle ground where patients exercise and eat during dialysis? So both speakers agree, Ray, protein diet, is it just the timings? Why not sort out, think other options, Ray, diet timing? And again, can high protein supplements improve nutritional status in hemodialysis patients? So Rajiv, any of those that you'd like to address? So, Ray.
Yeah, so and then Cam. There is a study that Al Pickisler published, IDPN versus oral supplements during dialysis, and I think Cam showed a slide on that. IDPN really doesn't do a whole lot more than the oral supplements. And the question we are debating is not about giving people protein and an adequate diet. The question we are having, the discussion we are having, is should the food be served during the critical times that the patient can get hypotensive? I mean, I'm going to just take a cue off Cam's thing, you know, their business class meal. Even if you're flying business class or first class, they will not serve you food when the aircraft is taking off or landing. They're not. You know, so, and this is the critical time that you're in the dialysis unit where you can get hypotensive. So why not wait till you reach a cruising altitude, you know, where you are at home to eat, and perhaps you need to exercise. And there's actually meta-analyses to show that aerobic exercise during dialysis prevents intradialytic hypertension and improves the efficiency of dialysis.
It's difficult for me to really, this guy is amazing. That's why I always admired him. But just one thing, I'm going to make sure, first of all, he's not upgraded to business class tomorrow when he's flying back. That's number one. The second thing is that if he is saying, Rajiv is saying that go and do weightlifting during dialysis, that's safe, but don't eat, right? So there is, in my opinion, seriously, there is a contradiction here. Now, I'm not saying exercise is bad. In fact, one of our dialysis units has stationary. But if we are going to go for a stationary, then if this is going to cause certain impact on the circulation, then just juxtapose this with eating during dialysis.
Actually has an opposite effect. So exercise during dialysis reduces intradialytic hypertension because it improves cardiac output, it improves skeletal blood flow, and therefore it reduces intradialytic hypertension. And meta-analyses, one published in American Journal of Nephrology just a few months ago, it analyzed all the data, and that's what it shows. So I'm just saying is that, look, there's a body of evidence that shows that eating on dialysis is bad for your blood pressure, whereas exercising on dialysis may be good. So which one would you rather choose?
Okay, let's ask two more related questions related to this. One is in children. We feed our children all the time. No problems like aspiration or pneumonia or IHD. They eat what they want. Are there studies in children? And the other question is, would it make sense to use blood volume monitoring to identify patients at risk for food-induced complications? And so I thought of something, too. I think really the gist of it is, obviously there are some patients you can feed during dialysis and they're not going to get hypotension, because hypotension incidence is 20%. Some people say it's less, depending upon how you define it. And then there are these patients who are at risk of malnutrition. And so I guess the key question is, are those same patients who are at risk for most at risk for malnutrition, who might benefit the most from extra feeding, are they also at the highest risk for IDH because of some type of autonomic nervous system insufficiency? Or are the two groups completely separate? I think that would be one issue that maybe...
Yeah, quickly, it's a very good point. I wish I had answered. As Dr. Agarwal astutely alluded to, this is essentially uncharted territory. It's amazing that all these great countries are feeding patients, and yet there are only four or five studies from 80s and 90s, as you noticed. So there is a lot of questions to explore. So it's a great opportunity for us to do research, great research, and see exactly what happens. And just one more thing, that if you're worried about aspiration, then why are we feeding the hospitalized patients? Then let's stop feeding them. And I don't mean to be sarcastic. If you're going to have an accident when you're driving on highway, so why are you driving? Just stay at home and don't drive.
Okay, Rajiv, give you a final word, and then we'll move to the extracorporeal circulation questions.
I think you're missing the point. You know, the question really is not about... in hospital, you feed patients, but you don't feed patients who have a swallowing problem or people who are at risk for aspiration. What I'm trying to point out is there's going to be a subset of patients who, if they have intradialytic hypertension and pass out, they're going to aspirate and they're going to have, you know, a problem with it. Well, what is the incidence of that? It's very, very small. But what is the consequence of it? It's very, very large. So you can have a rare event which can be fatal potentially, and that is something that we have to keep in mind. When we are doing randomized trials, we have to count these events and report it. If we don't, then we are not doing our community any service. So I agree we need high-quality research to answer these questions, but there is no free lunch. If you're going to feed patients, I expect that the hypertension will increase, but you have to count it prospectively, just like Dr. Sherman did and Dr. Zakali did in their 9-patient studies. If you don't, we are going to think that it's all safe, but without knowing the bad side of it.
Okay, so now we're going to do a post-test debate question. I guess, Conrad, you guys can figure this out, that we asked the question before the debate. How many people liked... Is this still doable? I understood that... So, debate results. Should hemodialysis patients be allowed to eat during treatment? Pre-debate, yes, 75%. Post-debate, 49%. Whoa. Looks like the dour and caution of Rajiv has also had an impact on people.
Right?
Well, it's actually your studies. You know, Dr. Dogherty's study is what I presented, so he can take the credit. None of the data were mine.
Okay. All right, so let's move to the extracorporeal circuit. The first thing I wanted to ask Dr. Winchester and Dr. Hoffman is hemoperfusion. We periodically do the handbook of dialysis, and we spent a lot of ink one time on hemoperfusion, and each time it seems like hemoperfusion is being used less and less in the dialysis in the U.S., and in fact, most people, you know, I tried to find out which hemoperfusion cartridges our hospital stocked, and it's fewer people are stocking these cartridges. So I'd like to ask both Dr. Hoffman and Jim, what do you see as the role of hemoperfusion? Do you guys use it in your place? How often is it used, and how useful is it compared to just dialysis now?
Thanks. So hemoperfusion is becoming a lost art in the United States, largely because it's hard to get the cartridges. And, you know, for me, in the middle of the night, you take somebody out of their comfort zone, which is doing, you know, intermittent hemodialysis, and you ask them to do something different, and they get a little nervous. Hemoperfusion was the great answer for things that are well adsorbed to charcoal. It was the standard for aluminum for so long. Theophylline became that drug. The majority, and over the intervening 25 years, hemodialysis has become a more efficient technique. You know, we're thinking mostly in the United States about lithium, no role for charcoal, methanol and ethylene glycol, no role for charcoal. Those are our big three, and number four is probably metformin-associated lactic acidosis right now, where the acid base in the fluid electrolytes are pretty high, and then a lot of aspirin, which would be great for charcoal, but you lose the correction of the acid-base balance. So in the U.S., hemoperfusion is both becoming unavailable and becoming unnecessary. In other places around the globe, in Asia, especially China, where they're thinking about paraquats and pesticides, there's still a fair amount of hemoperfusion being done. In my perfect world, and we've done this, or we had done it in the past, it would be wonderful to put hemoperfusion and hemodialysis in series under select circumstances where you put the filter before the charcoal and the charcoal picks up the little bits that come out the other end. But under most circumstances, I think you could go an entire career in the U.S. as a nephrologist, and I would add Canada to that as well, in the U.S. and Canada as a nephrologist and never have to consider hemoperfusion anymore.
Okay. Jim, do you have anything to add?
I would agree with that. I think I got the last charcoal cartridge in the country in the U.S. For the treatment of the aluminum poisoning. And I'd agree entirely that for metabolic acidosis, hemodialysis is the method of choice.
Okay, the other question I wanted to ask is, when do you think dialysis is being used for poisoning, that it's being misused? So what are the most common times when you think dialysis is being used erroneously, where it shouldn't be used, maybe people should be attacking the GI tract by charcoal absorption or something else? And just your experience from what you find in your X-trip reports. And
if you look carefully, and it takes a lot of time to read through the American Association of Poison Control reports, you'll see that dialysis is actually being used appropriately. It's been used for salicylate poisoning, whereas charcoal hemoperfusion would be used for barbiturates and so on. So it is being used appropriately. People are looking at the guidelines and doing quite well for dialysis.
The inappropriate times...
Turn it on.
Is it on? They can hear me.
Yeah.
I'm still on? Yeah, that's great. The inappropriate use, cyclic antidepressants, digoxin, you still fear a fair amount. And then we're trying to sort out, because the database is a little confusing, you see a lot of dialysis around opioids. We have a great antidote, naloxone, and the clearance is not that good. But if you look deeper in the data, it's, you know, myoglobinuric acute kidney injury from being down, and the dialysis is not so much for removal of the toxin, but for the complication of the overdose. And there I would consider that appropriate if it was considered. We always challenge people to say, if you're bothering to hook them up for something that's a little less than traditional, collect a few specimens and let's just see what we get. But the nice part is that the vast majority of the cases are really appropriate.
Great. So we're on time. I'd like to thank all of our speakers for a wonderful presentation.